Hey, welcome back, everybody, to my podcast. And today's episode is with none other than Dr. Sherry Ma. And if you're a regular on my podcast, you may wonder who she is, because this is my first science episode. I feel like I need to introduce her properly. She's a sleep physician. She works with teams such as the Golden State Warriors from the NBA. She works with teams from the NFL, NHL, Major League Baseball, such as the San Francisco Giants. She worked with companies such as Nike, ESPN, Gatorade, and many more. Today, she shared some very insightful stories about Andre Iguodala and her work with him, how he improved his sleep and therefore improved his performances, extended his career, quite frankly. She also gave us some really good hacks for hacking and improving, preparing for jet lag when you change continents, when you change time zones, especially long-term travel. This is an episode catered towards scouts, players, coaches, assistant coaches. Everybody who's on the road in our business knows what it feels like when you don't get enough sleep. So please listen to this episode. There's lots of nuggets to take away. Please share this episode with athletes and coaches, anybody who needs to listen around the world. There's lots of things to take away. Please subscribe if you're not subscribed yet. If you're a subscriber, thank you for being here. I'm looking forward for hearing your comments, seeing your comments, and talk to you soon. Bye. Dr. Sherry Ma, welcome to my little basketball podcast world.
I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's been a back and forth a little bit, and we made it happen. Originally, or let me start with this. We have a common connection because Anthony Goetz was somebody that was at Stanford when you made a sleep study with the team, and was, I don't know if it was with him particular or with the team, but it raised the question for me, how did you get yourself into this topic? How did you discover this, the importance of sleep?
I have been in the sleep field for over 20 years, and my journey started as a 17-year-old who was initially doing a research study at Stanford with what was the pioneer of the field. His name was Dr. William Dement, and he is the founding father of the field of modern sleep medicine. So I had the unique opportunity to start to do research with him, looking at how we could extend sleep in undergraduates and see if there's positive benefits. And by chance, we had some athletes in that study who came into the lab one day and said, you're looking at reaction time and mood levels and fatigue, but I just want to let you know I set a couple records in my last swim meet. And that was sort of this aha moment that I was like, maybe there's actually the manifestation of performance benefits for specifically athletes. And that's sort of what led me down this path. So I fast forwarded to my master's, where I did specifically research on the Stanford men's basketball team, examining if there are positive benefits on their reaction time, their mood, and ultimately on-court performance. So it was a little bit of a circuitous route, but that has led me down this interesting path where I really enjoy the application of science and working with athletes and teams.
Yeah, we're going to have we're going to be bouncing back and forth. I have a whole bunch of questions that I pop into my head randomly, probably. So please allow me to jump topics sometimes, because they randomly pop up through some manifestation as well on my part. But shout out to Anthony Goetz in this segment of the podcast. His reaction time is pretty good, I can say. Coming back to our first opportunity when we had to schedule a podcast, and then I'd said 10:30 would be my time, and at night, it was like probably you got an anxiety attack when I said 10:30 is too late to have a podcast. So we rescheduled. It's around 6:30 right now, PM. But that's something that I also talk to my colleagues about when I'm on the road, and one of them we had recently that I had a conversation with about sleep time and when going to sleep. And I also remember when I was going to sleep too late, I could say after midnight, like around 1 a.m. or something like that, and I woke up, although I slept the same amount of time, let's say 7 to 8 hours, I felt groggy. But if I went to sleep around 10:30, 11, and I slept the same amount of time, I felt pretty good. And although it's the same amount of time, I was wondering what the issues with that, what the difference is with that? Because I heard, and this is like, maybe it's a myth, maybe not, but I remember that there's also a particular amount of deep sleep that you get in a certain part of the night, and you may be able to skip over it if you go to sleep too late. Is that true or is it not true? What's the correlation there?
All great questions. So yes, the timing of your sleep can also matter beyond just duration. Duration is one bucket that I focus on with athletes. There's also the quality of your sleep, which we can dive into later. There's lots of factors that go into the quality of your sleep. And then there's the timing of when you sleep, as you're discussing. And so while you may still have gotten your typical 7 or 8 hours in that window, when you shift the time of your sleep, bedtime and wake time, that can also very much affect the sleep that you get at nighttime. One important factor to think about in that timing is your chronotype. What that means is that naturally we each have a predilection to be either an evening owl. So you tend to want to go to bed late under your own devices, and then you want to wake up later. Or some individuals are morning larks. So they like to wake up in the morning time early and they like to go to bed later. And then there's some that fall in the middle where they don't necessarily fall into one extreme or the other. And I think we all kind of have a sense of which one we are. I personally am an evening owl more so than a morning lark, but I, through much of a decade of medical training, was on a schedule that we had to be up in the morning. And so sometimes socially, whether for work or other obligations for family or kids, you are up at an earlier time than maybe would be against or with your predilection for your chronotype. So that's another factor to consider, where it would be better if you could align your sleep schedule with your chronotype. So in other words, if you are a night person, it would be better if your sleep schedule allowed you to go to bed later and wake up later. If you are a morning person, to have that preferred schedule earlier in the daytime. To your point about deep sleep, you do get different types of sleep during the night. We have light sleep, and then we have deep sleep. That deep sleep is really important for muscle recovery, regeneration. You get the biggest pulse of growth hormone during your deep sleep. And then there's this dreaming sleep, where we call it rapid eye movement sleep. And you go through this cycle about 90 minutes to 120 minutes every cycle, and multiple cycles throughout the night, depending on how long of a duration you allow your body to sleep for. And proportionally get more of that deep sleep earlier in the night than you do in the last couple of hours in those early morning, where you get more of that REM, or that's when we dream the most. And that's important for learning, memory, and consolidation.
Yeah, I'm definitely a night owl, and I feel it also because I feel way more productive and up and going at nighttime, where I want to watch some basketball. I want to dive into some phone calls you can probably make also with the US during this time. So it's a little bit a natural feeling that I have, like you said. And in the podcast with Stephen Bartlett on the Diary of a CEO, I think you dove into that topic as well. I think that episode was, I wrote it down, August 2024. It was very good for everybody who wants to dive more into that. That was a really good episode. But how much damage do I do to my body if I do go to sleep late and then I wake up early? And let's say if I go to sleep at 12 and I wake up at 6, and how much is there that I lose?
So when we look at chronic sleep loss, you describe 6 hours, which is, we would consider, insufficient sleep for the average adult. So the recommendation is 7 hours minimally for every adult to prevent health risks and performance decrements. And that's a lower threshold, right? So I don't feel great on 7 hours. I feel much better on, honestly, 8.5 or 9. So there is individual variability between myself to you, Bennis, to everyone else that's listening. And you do have to find what works for you. And there could be a larger spectrum of what is sufficient for you to function and feel to your best during the daytime. There is actually no upper limit any longer. They did away with that a couple years ago, at least by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, for our recommendations here in the US. And that's because there are specific populations, such as elite athletes, who we likely do think need more purely duration than the weekend warrior or the recreational individual. And so they may benefit from 9+ hours of sleep. Or, for example, if you remember back in college, being a very sleep deprived college student, they also could benefit from additional hours of sleep. So when you are saying that you're getting 6 hours of sleep and you're doing that chronically, that really can affect your cognitive performance. So whether you're able to make, well, arguably not able to make when you're sleep deprived, not able to make good decisions, are not able to react quickly under pressure. Your judgment is impaired. You definitely are not at a state in which you're able to respond as well as if you had quality rest under your belt. Physiologically, we know that affects your hormonal levels. It can affect your higher risk for acute infections. You have a higher risk for injury. And then physically, we also know that that can impact on-court performance and when it comes to the physical performance outcome measures. So when you have that chronic sleep loss, it is something that we are mindful to encourage people to reduce what we call accumulated sleep debt, because you're accumulating this debt by not getting sufficient sleep every day.
You can make up for that debt?
Yes. We do think that you can make up what we call short-term or acute sleep debt. And that's actually a focus of much of my research, is using an intervention called sleep extension, where you get more sleep than you typically would to start to pay back some of that debt. And that's where I've seen over multiple weeks, there's an improvement in reaction time. You know, athletes have less fatigue, they have more vigor or energy, and then on-court performance can be improved, specifically in my basketball study. So when I did an extended sleep opportunity 5 to 7 weeks with Stanford men's basketball team, they had a 9% improvement in their free throws, 9% improvement in their three-point shots. They reacted 12% faster, and their sprint time was 4% faster, as well as lower fatigue levels. And they honestly felt better in terms of subjective ratings, both in practice and in games. And obviously that can be incredibly important. And yeah, we are unsure a bit more on the long-term sleep loss. Like if you've been getting 5 hours of sleep for 3 decades, right? Some of that accumulated debt, which can have some physiologic effects, may not be as reversible versus if you only did the last week of 5 hours of sleep. We do think and encourage you to pay back that debt.
I could, on myself, I could feel that my immune system was dropping off whenever I was underslept, or if I was, you know, traveling a lot, and naturally you lose some time with the time travel, with the time zone changes. But I felt like the immune system was taking a hit on that. Is that also related?
Yes, that's true. So one study, I think, really illustrates that point, especially right now we're in winter season, cold and flu season. There was a study by colleagues who looked at your increased risk to get even the common cold. And you're actually 4 times more likely to catch the common cold when you're getting 6 or less hours of sleep versus if you were getting 7 hours. And that's huge. 4 times yeah. more likely is huge, especially if you are an elite athlete and obviously want to avoid getting sick when it matters in season.
For sure. So just like more or less 1 hour makes a difference completely in your whole immune system and the just sustaining your health throughout the year.
Definitely. So that's why I recommend trying to get to 7 hours minimally. And that's okay if you're not there. Say you're at 6 hours. I don't recommend suddenly trying to get 9 hours tomorrow. Gradual and small changes over time are better. And so even if that means starting with 15 or 30 minutes more sleep every day this week, over a week's time, you would have almost 2 hours more sleep total. And that's huge. So it doesn't have to be big gains. And I actually recommend those smaller adjustments. And so it can be even the difference of 15 minutes does matter.
Yeah. So like if I have seven and a half hours in a night, if I make it up with a nap, 30 minute nap or 45 minute nap in a day, is that kind of like, does it even out, or does that not add up?
So I look at naps really just as a performance and alertness boost. I don't like to necessarily consider it the same as what you could get for consolidated sleep at night. I'd much rather you get 8 hours from 10 to 6, at nighttime, then try to break it up and get 6 hours at night and then 2 hours of a nap in the afternoon. The stages of sleep that you can get when it's consolidated perhaps could be impacted when it's consolidated. And really, I think the short power naps is the goal during the daytime, because those can give you a boost temporarily, but they won't affect your sleep as much at nighttime. Versus if you took that 2 hour long power nap, a lot of people will wake up feeling groggy and sluggish. I'm sure this has happened at some point to you. That's because you're waking up from deeper stages of sleep and you have that sluggishness feeling we call sleep inertia. So it's not great, because then now you're trying to go out and perform after you have this sluggishness that can persist for some time, as well as that long nap can decrease your drive to sleep. And so it can be harder to sleep at nighttime when you want to. And so that can then shift your whole sleep schedule. So really the goal is short power naps during the daytime, 20 to 30 minutes, and then trying to have the goal of at least 7, but arguably 8 to 10 hours during the nighttime for elite athletes.
And this is where the Nappuccino comes into play.
Yes. Have you tried the Nappuccino?
I've tried inadvertently. I think I have it done, because after lunch, sometimes you have an espresso, or, you know, in Italy, you're not allowed to have a cappuccino after lunch. So if you're wherever, depending on where you are, I did have it inadvertently after a big meal. You do have coffee to digest it, and then you fall asleep. But I also had it at nighttime. I used to have it. I stopped drinking caffeine in the afternoon, or coffee in the afternoon rather, because of the half-life of caffeine, that is 6 hours, I believe. So that's why I was kind of thinking about the Nappuccino, but also in regards to, it's probably good for performance, but for getting deep sleep and REM sleep at night, if you have a Nappuccino late in the evening before a game, let's say, the caffeine is still going to be in your body to really obstruct the deep sleep. Or am I thinking too deep a little bit with that?
No, you are being strategic of timing for your Nappuccino. So for those of you that may not be familiar with the Nappuccino, this is a tool that I think can be quite effective to give yourself an alertness and performance boost temporarily if timed correctly. And what it is you go take your favorite caffeinated beverage, and then caffeine will start to come on board within 15 minutes. So after you have your caffeinated beverage, you go and take your short power nap, ideally 20 to 30 minutes. And you do have to fall asleep within 5 to 10 minutes for obviously this to work. But if you're able to, then you have your power nap for 20 to 30 minutes, and then you wake up, and then both the caffeine will have kicked in during the time that you're taking that power nap, as well as the benefits of a short power nap. And so there's research to show that this is actually more effective than just doing caffeine alone or just having that power nap. So it's a useful tool, but to your point, Bennis, like, you do want to time it correctly, because if you do a Nappuccino quite late into the afternoon or even the evening time, the half-life of caffeine is approximately 6 hours. So by the time, let's say, it's midnight, half of it could still be quite active. And that can be challenging for individuals to be able then to fall asleep when they want to. Now, there are faster metabolizers and slower metabolizers of caffeine. But I think it's an interesting, caffeine is an interesting performance enhancer, and it is one that many athletes utilize. So it's just trying to find the right balance of the timing of when to utilize it, and ideally infrequently, so you get that performance benefit, but also figuring out when in the day you can do so that hopefully you're not impacting your sleep as much following the game or when you actually want to sleep. So if you can do a Nappuccino earlier in the afternoon, that's more ideal. I do have some athletes that do it a little bit later. Sometimes we'll go for more of a decaf, so they have a little bit of the caffeine, but not as strong as a full brew. And otherwise, trying to minimize kind of in-game use of caffeine, because just the later you get into the night, it's more challenging then for them to sleep after.
Yeah, that's something that we're going to talk about later a little bit, about the sleep for athletes after games because of the elevated adrenaline. And I'll dive into that afterwards. But I was going to touch on something from my youth, and I'm wondering how much damage I did to my body. Because in high school in Germany, there's one game a week from the NBA that was on at 3 o'clock in the morning from Sunday to Monday. And I was waking up every Sunday and Monday morning early to watch the game from 3 to 6. I took another hour nap, let's say, you know, to get the little bit of sleep amount that I can before I go to school. And I did it basically during the season, almost every Sunday night, you know. So I'm sure that, I mean, that day was always groggy and that was strange. But, you know, as a teenager, you compensate a little bit easier. But potentially, plus I ate a lot of chocolate and drank Coca-Cola during the night, I destroyed my whole night of sleep of any kind. What damage did I, potentially do to my body?
Oh, well, this was a little while ago. Obviously, this was high school. I mean, the high school age is an interesting time period because, one, you need around 8 to 10 hours of sleep when you're in that adolescent teenage years. So it is higher of a physiologic need than adults. And so 8 to 10 hours is really the recommendation for every teenager to, again, be able to perform well in school, be able to be healthy, and be able to function appropriately. Now, at the high school age, too, you have this interesting shift in your body clock where you naturally want to go to bed later and naturally you want to wake up later. As you become an adult, that clock shifts backwards a bit. And so for many teenagers, it's a struggle because they don't want to go to bed earlier in the evening time, but then they're forced to wake up typically quite early to start school. And so it curtails their total sleep time significantly. And it's been an ongoing issue. At least here in the United States, there's now been some changes in legislation, and certain states, like I'm in, based in California, have enacted legislation where they've pushed back the start time of schools to allow students to be able to get the sleep that they need and physiologically align their sleep a bit more, because there's a significant amount of research studies that show it helps with attendance, with test scores, with mental health, with less car accidents. And so I think this is a really important time period in life where we have an opportunity to help students also build better sleep habits earlier on. To your question of what damage happened since then, I mean, I'm hoping that you were able to, you know, get back to a little bit normal schedule once you got into your adult life and weren't waking up for those 3 hours in the middle of the night. But maybe you also paid back some of that debt at a later time point, whether it was then the following day and you gave yourself an extended opportunity to catch up a bit more. But I do want to emphasize that we know when sleep debt accumulates, it requires more than one night or one weekend of additional recovery sleep to actually pay back significantly that debt. And that's where, yes, my studies have been over multiple weeks, but that's where you see the biggest benefit rather than just trying to get one additional night or one weekend of that extra sleep.
So it made me smile because in college, I was in communication. I graduated with a degree in communications, as you probably cannot tell it, judging by the podcast, the way it's going so far. No, just kidding. We had a debate class, and I threw out the topic of what to debate about. And I said, we should debate about not starting class that early and move it to a little bit later. And now I just got laughed out of the room. It was just like, nah, we're not going to talk about it. And now 20 years later, here we go. It's actually a debated topic. So I should have been more firm on it, but I probably was underslept then.
Ahead of the curve. I wish you had pursued a bit more. I'm sure there'd be healthier students if you had done so.
I don't think in college there's a lot of healthy students there. So just going a little bit into the travel schedule for scouts, for coaches, for people who are traveling across time zones. I'll tell you how I deal with it going back and forth, and mostly between Europe and Boston. So it's really 6 hours, more or less. And the way I prepare for those trips, now with time, I learned to read my body a little better, feel my body a little bit better, the way I react to certain food or whatever. And I learned that on the flights to Boston, for example, I try to eat less or not to eat at all. I try to be in a fasted state while I fly. I also eliminated alcohol while flying, or any type of beverages, or even sugary beverages, either way. And when I get there, or if I come back, I try to have a little workout, break a sweat, and have a little bit to help my circadian rhythm adjust a little bit faster, quicker to it. I try not to sleep while I'm there because I arrive usually early to late afternoon. So I try to drag myself into the night, into like 9, 10 a.m. p.m. so I can just basically pass out and then sleep to the morning. And I usually wake up around 5 o'clock in the morning the first couple nights. But is there anything that I could do extra to help myself to get adjusted faster to the jet lag? Or is there anything that I am skipping over?
Great question. Travel is a big challenge, I think, for a lot of individuals, because the rule of thumb is that for every time zone you cross, it takes one day for your body clock to adjust. So obviously this depends on how far you're traveling, and also the direction of your travel matters. Our bodies have a more challenging time flying eastward than they does when it flies westward. And that's in part because our body clock is longer than 24 hours. It's 24 hours and 11 minutes. So trying to what's called advance our clock when we fly eastward is more challenging. And therefore it makes it harder to adjust than when we fly westward. So one, it'll depend. Are you flying from Boston to Europe, or are you going Europe to Boston, right? Because the direction of travel matters. And the way that I would recommend to break up every trip is to think of strategies in three buckets: what you do pre-flight, so in advance of even getting on the airplane, what you do in flight, and then what you do post-flight. And you've identified a couple of strategies in the in-flight, post-flight buckets, but I would say one challenge for you is thinking about what you can do even before you get on that airplane. So in that first bucket, one is to make sure you're not going into especially long flights with sleep loss. We know that sleep deprivation makes jet lag worse. So at least two nights, if not that week leading up, make sure you're getting sufficient 7 hours or more of sleep so that you have a good foundation and not short on sleep before you get on the airplane, because we know that'll make it more challenging. Now, depending on which direction you're traveling, let's say you're going from Boston to Europe, so you're eastward traveling. You have an opportunity, even though it is a 6 hour difference is typically what you're doing. Yeah. So you can shift your sleep schedule about 30 minutes to an hour for a couple of days leading up into the trip. And what that means is going to bed earlier and then waking up earlier. And then when you wake up, you want to get sunlight, because sunlight is the most powerful signal to the brain to help your body clock reset. And so when you're traveling eastward, it's that morning sunlight that you really want. When you're traveling westward, it's actually the late afternoon sunlight that you want to get. Mm-hmm. And so those are two strategies, even before you get on a flight, that can be helpful, because if you shift your body clock two or three time zones before you jump on the airplane, then you only need to adjust another three time zones when you arrive versus trying to do six, right? So that's one. Those are a couple of strategies for the pre-flight. In flight, you identified not having, I think you said alcohol, caffeine,
sugar. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And sugar is helpful. You want to stay really hydrated on flights, especially mm-hmm. long flights, because dehydration also can make jet lag worse. Thinking about the timing of when you should be sleeping, so aligning with the destination sleep is ideal, so that you can try to get on that schedule immediately and not just kind of free form whenever you want to take a nap or not, because that's not very helpful in trying to sync up your body clock. Mm-hmm. And there could be some suggestion around the timing of meals to try to start to align your meals with the destination. And then part, the thought is that every cell in your body has a clock, and those, even in your gut, we call them peripheral clocks. You have a master clock in your brain that controls your circadian rhythm or your body clock. And all the cells in your body communicate with that master clock. And so if you start to sync up the timing of meals, that potentially could help inform shifting that master clock. Now, when you arrive into the new time zone, the post-flight strategies are going to be, number one, sunlight is the most powerful signal we've already discussed. So making sure you're getting it at the appropriate time, depending on the travel destination. You can use caffeine and power nap strategically when you have a dip in your alertness, because your body is lagging behind where you are when you first arrive. Exercise can be helpful. I would say for elite athletes, you don't want to go all out 100% max exercise when you initially get to a new location, because there could be potentially some injury risk with jet lag. And then trying to be diligent about how you're sleeping when you're in this new time zone. So optimizing your sleep environment, making it really dark, quiet, cool, comfortable, and consistent. I do recommend even building a travel sleep kit. And so you have tools to optimize your environment when it may not be ideal. And so there's a lot of these different factors that go into it, but I think hopefully that gives you a framework to think about the different time points in which to have strategies for each trip.
Yeah, the from all of the things that you mentioned, the most difficult part is when I'm flying eastward back to Europe and landing in the first half of the day in the morning, because usually it's a night flight. And then, or, you know, around lunchtime, you still have the whole day to stay awake. And then if you eat anything, you basically, your body basically just says goodbye, because it starts digesting, it starts working, and then you start wanting to sleep. And so that's the most difficult part. But like you said, if you do your work ahead of time and you prepare a little bit better for the circadian clock to shift, and you save 2 or 3 hours by arrival time, that could help probably potentially make the day a little bit easier, because, you know, like you said, going eastward is definitely much harder.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, hopefully you can try some of those strategies out on your next trip and let me know how it goes.
I will. So the same problem also with the travel for anybody, because in this business, we all travel the whole time, is new beds and hotels, new environment. And from the information that I picked up throughout the years, is ancestrally, we were also the hunters and gatherers were always aware when they had to go to new areas to hunt for food, that they also could be hunted. So they always kind of, when they had to go into new environment, they were always alert and never got into a deep sleep mode. And now there's a correlation: when you go into hotels, when you go into a new bed, new environment, you never are fully at rest. Is that true or is that a myth?
So this is a good point you raise, which is called the first night effect. So this is a scientifically founded phenomenon where individuals tend to not sleep as well when you're in a new environment for the first time. And the thought is that, yes, it is a protective mechanism so that we are still vigilant around with our surroundings in case something is alarming or, you know, could cause us harm. And so studies have shown that our brains, particularly our left side of the brain, stays more alert and awake than what would happen if you were sleeping in your own home and in your own bedroom that is a familiar and safe environment. And so a lot of individuals, when they go on a trip and they're sleeping in that hotel for that first night, sometimes, you know, longer, they know they don't sleep as well. They're like, I wake up more tired. I don't feel like I got the quality sleep. And so there is evidence that this is a manifestation of the, you know, your body trying to at least make sure that you're in a safe environment when you're sleeping. I think the things that practically you can do to minimize this effect, since obviously many of us do travel and will be in hotels or in new locations, is trying to make your environment as familiar as possible. And what that means is if you bring things that you use at home on the road, such as I recommend bringing your pillow. I really love all of my athletes to bring the pillow, not only to minimize this first night effect, but also so that's actually a consistent sleep surface. Mm-hmm. So many athletes just complain about terrible hotel pillows, or it's not the type that they like and they can't get a different one, or don't even think to ask for one that they prefer. And then they wake up with a neck cramp and like, hey, I mean, that's not the best situation to go out and play a game when you don't get a good night's sleep. And now you have maybe, you know, a strain. And so traveling with your own pillow means it'll be consistent and you'll be more comfortable and can minimize that first night effect. if you use any types of, for example, scents like lavender spray, that can be used at home and on the road, then that can be a more familiar effect. Others bring even just a pillowcase so that the smell of home comes with them and it's easy to travel with, or say it's a photo. So you choose the things that work for you, but that can be helpful to try and minimize that effect when you're traveling and sleeping in these new environments. I'm curious if you've seen other players or yourself do things on the road to try and minimize jet lag or try to minimize this first night effect.
I thought about bringing your own mattress. I can't do that. I've seen players bring their own pillows. Yeah, I've seen that, but I don't know if it was particularly consciously done because of the first night effect or if it's just for just general comfort, but it leads subsequently, it leads to a better night of sleep. I've seen players being cognizant of it and just preparing themselves a little bit better, napping on a plane a little bit, and this kind of resting and preparing themselves for a shift in time zones, even within Europe. And the bigger question right now is, which coaches are battling with, especially coaches in Turkey. Turkey eliminated the daylight savings time, so now they didn't move the clock, and rest of Europe fell back one hour. Right, so now there is 2 hour difference instead of 1 hour difference, and there is definitely a struggle with that in amongst the Turkish coaches community. So what would you suggest? Because we're going to dive into the study now that we also talked about a little bit ahead of time. And then also a big article on that with big contribution on your part. The difference in the time zones and the schedules that are set in the NBA, for example, I have it written down, the Schedule Alert Project by ESPN and you and yourself, that there was there's the main factors were travel back-to-back and time zone shifts, and no correlation between the strength of schedule. So you didn't pay attention to the teams that they play against, whether they were ranked above or below. But we can definitely compare these two with the problem in Europe and the problem in the NBA with the condensed schedule, where the 2 hour shift in Europe now is where the games on the West Coast, for example, in Spain, would be at 8 o'clock, and for the Turkish teams it would be at midnight. They're automatically at a disadvantage. And in the US, it's a 3 hour difference between the East Coast and the West Coast teams. So there's a significant difference between the two parties, let's say, between the two conferences, if they go all the way to the West Coast. What does this study, this Schedule Alert Project, really coincide with the wins and losses that you researched in that was 2011, right? Or 2018 it was published, I think, right? 2017, 2018.
Yes. So the Schedule Alert Project was a collaboration with ESPN. We looked at three seasons of data from 2016 to 2017, 18 and 19. So over those three seasons, 2016 all the way through the 2019 season. And the premise of this was, they asked me, you know, Dr. Ma, can you predict when NBA teams are at highest risk of losing strictly based on the schedule? Now, we obviously know many other factors contribute to wins and losses, including strength of team. But in the spirit of the project, they said, let's blind us to the strength of team and really just focus on schedule related, travel related, sleep and recovery related factors that I thought would really impact outcomes. Because the background to this project was that they felt if we could bring awareness to some of these other factors that may not be as, that people may not put as much weight towards, then it could actually illustrate that these could be, powerful factors at play that really should be, we hold with more respect and understanding that it is important for the health and performance of athletes beyond, just looking at strength of team. And so it was an interesting challenge. And I was like, oh my goodness, this could be really, this could go really well or really poorly, depending on these predictions. But the first season, I looked at 8 different factors. Part of it did include game density, travel schedule, home versus away, opportunities or the lack of opportunities for adequate sleep and recovery. And in that first 2016 to 2017 year, there were what we called the worst of the worst games or red alert games. And of those games, I was 76% correct in the end, because we published those games as predictions before the season started, and you can follow along with them. So the end of the year, I was 76% correct in those worst of those worst scenarios. In that next season, 2017-2018, I actually reviewed the last 10 years of data for all the NBA teams. Again, we're not accounting for strength of team, nor are we accounting for injuries, DNP rest, or even ejections in this scenario. And also showed that we obviously were pretty accurate in terms of getting the predictions to be in the same ballpark. And to dive a little bit more deeply into scenarios where the teams were behind, say at halftime, I think when we looked back, teams were like 1 in 32 if they were behind or tied at halftime. And so it was really challenging for them to come back. If they were behind or tied at the third quarter, I think it was like 1 in 35. And then it was like 3 in 36 if they were behind by double digits at any time in the game. And so overall, then we go to the third season. And overall, over those three seasons, I was 76 to 86% correct in predicting these worst case scenarios. So it was a really fun project. I think hopefully that shed light on these other travel and schedule related factors that, you know, I believe really do influence these outcomes, not just for the individual level, but organizations as a whole.
For sure. It's a big... Well, it raises awareness, first of all. Like you said, it's supposed to shed light on the problematic there. But what's the coach to do if you're tied to the schedule? How can you prepare? I'm sure like you can prepare yourself in some way, minimally, but every percentage matters. So what's the small percentage that coaches could do when they're tied to the schedule?
I think coaches actually have a really critical and important role in this. Despite, yes, some factors are out of their control that the schedule is set by the league, right? And there's things that are not as controllable from the league standpoint. But I will say, one, I think they can be strategic in designing a system and a schedule that the players who are having to live within can be better supported. So what does that mean? Number one, they do have some control over their own team's practice schedule when they're both at home and on the road. I think there is some flexibility for selecting better flight times when there is options to be able to fly at better times for sleep or not, and especially with when you consider jet lag when you cross multiple time zones. Number three, I think there's opportunities to support logistically, like in the facility space, having a place for a nap room or a sleep room, which is becoming more popular, and being able to support some of the practical logistics so that players who need to take a power nap, they have the facility space. Because I've heard and seen players nap in storage closets, training tables, you know, the kitchen area, and so less than ideal, of course. So from a logistics standpoint, that could be helpful. And then really the most important thing is like the culture and setting the tone that sleep is valued and prioritized by the organization. It's not something that the players, staff, or coaches should be sacrificing, and really setting an example for the players and staff that this is such a critical part for all of us to be at our best. And I think that's the bottom line is what coaches can do to really make sure that this is a part of the organization's culture.
So if the team from Turkey has to travel to Spain, they're tied to practicing in the first part of the day and then flying in the afternoon, I assume. I don't know the schedule, but that would make the most sense. So the arrival time is automatically late in the evening for them when they should go right away to sleep, or what are they bound to do? Because then if you have sleep aids, you automatically have a not as fluid sleep at night, and then you have to wake up in the morning, you're groggy, and then the whole game day, you're a little bit off, then you have to probably compensate with a nap, with a longer nap in the afternoon, you're groggy again. So I can see that being really a big problem with the day before the game when they travel after they practice at home, or should they practice in the visiting arena after, if they fly early in the day before?
Yeah, I'd have to look at the specifics, but I think that if there is opportunity to fly in that late morning period, I personally, as a general rule of thumb, like that, because hopefully you will have had sufficient sleep the night before. And so you're not going to have this large drive to sleep once you get on the airplane, because that's a mistake that a lot of people make, is whenever they get on an airplane, they just try and sleep through the whole thing. And then their sleep is completely shifted once they arrive in the new location. So late morning flights, generally, I do like as a preference. So then you get into a new location. If it means then in this scenario, they get in the afternoon, potentially if the facility space is available and they have a practice in the afternoon to early evening, that's also a way to obviously just be able to shake off the flight a bit, get a little exercise, and then try to actually have a more strategic way of preparing to sleep for the night that's more aligned with the destination time zone. So without looking at the specifics, I do think that that could be an interesting option if the schedule allows for it.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most logical part. I think that the only problem is that the teams that you're flying to, they may not allow you to practice in the afternoon. So there's also a factor that the coaches cannot control all the time. But let's talk a little bit about the performance window between 4 and 8 p.m. in the afternoon, where most, like I think you said it on Stephen Bartlett's podcast, that's where the records are broken. Most world records are broken in that period. And that shifts from when they go from East Coast to West Coast, that window can shift, but not for the West Coast team, because they're basically anytime, they're always in that window. So if they play on the East Coast, they play in the evening, they're still in that window. What is the study with the NFL teams that you also cited in that podcast?
Yeah, so this is really focusing on that there's this window in our 24-hour day, typically around 4 to 8 p.m. where performance is enhanced. That's when world records are broken, people perform their best, and that's just a factor of this natural circadian rhythm or our body clock where alertness is typically peaking at this point. And so the study that you're mentioning is, the original study was the Monday night NFL study. And it actually inspired me to get into sleep and sports. I thought it was such a cool study that was done by who is now a mentor. And he was looking at 25 seasons of NFL games and showed that if you look at specifically the matchups between East Coast, West Coast teams at night games. So again, East Coast, West Coast matchups during night games, it does not matter which coast that the team is playing on. If you simply bet on the West Coast team, you would beat the Las Vegas point spread 68% of the time. And that's huge. And the reason is, as you mentioned, the body clocks are 3 hours different between the East Coast and West Coast team. Now, again, regardless of which coast you're playing on, the West Coast body clock is operating 3 hours earlier. And so statistically, over 25 seasons, it won't play out in every game, but that difference of body clock is a performance advantage to the West Coast team because they're playing closer to that 4 to 8 p.m., whether it's on the West Coast or, you play on the East Coast and the East Coast body clock is just is 3 hours later. So that was the original study. And then I expanded it with Dr. Roger Smith, which is the original author, to 40 seasons up to 2011. And we found that the West Coast teams were twofold more likely to beat the point spread versus the East Coast teams. And this just strengthened those findings as well, that, there is this body clock advantage when it gets to the night games in particular.
Well, so when having this in front of you and you present it to players and one way or the other, you have to gain their trust. And how, what's the easiest way to prove to a player that this is beneficial for the player, and not only in the short term, but also in the long term? Because I can imagine early on when it was not such a big topic, it was kind of hard. It's like, yeah, sleeping, whatever. Like I can sleep in the afternoon. There's no real correlation, because you also, you know, the measuring part is also a long term project that you have to really commit to. How do you gain the player's trust with that?
Oh, this is a good question, because it's a challenging one, right? For anyone to want to be open to making adjustments in their habits, in their lifestyle, and making adjustments for something that they've probably done for many years and have found a lot of success, right? They're probably playing at the highest level and have found ways that they feel work for them. So the ways that I have found to build trust with NBA players is really just understanding their motivation, right? And really, at the end of the day, it's often not about sleep. What it is about is like, how do I help you extend your career longevity? Mm-hmm. How do I help you improve your on-court performance? Ultimately, how do we get you to win a championship, right? And that's what they're motivated by. Sleep is one avenue that I know can be helpful to get them into a more successful position for these things. And then supporting that by showing them, you know, just very high level, some of the research to support that with quantifiable numbers. And then I think it is also about illustrating some of these case studies where I've had successful athletes at the highest level be all-stars, but yet when we actually came in and helped them be more strategic around their sleep, they saw on-court performance improvements. They ended up winning more championships. They and are very outspoken about it. And so that obviously provides the success measures that a lot of athletes are striving for. And at the end of the day, I always start with very small and practical steps or suggestions to change, because it's not about big swings. Those are never helpful. We start with small baby steps. And once they experience the benefit of even a 5-minute wind down routine and seeing how that actually can prepare their body and their brain to get better sleep that night, then they're willing to do the next step. And you build on that over time. So just like any other behavior or lifestyle change, sleep does take time to see the effects. But if you're willing to put everything it takes to be the best athlete possible, and you're willing to put in some time and be diligent and committed to it, I promise those effects are going to come down the line.
Yeah, I think base hits, like you're saying, was step by step. And I think the highest level athletes, they take pride in that, and they try to enhance their game on the court as well as off the court. But this is a good segue to Andre Iguodala's story, that you also mentored him through this process. And I'm wondering, what was his situation before you met him and afterwards? Like, what, how far apart was his routine to where it needed to be? Like, this was there a big difference? Was there a small step that he had to take? Where was he before and after?
Oh, it was huge. It was massive. It was like this.
A crater.
it was enormous. But he has been very open about this story and about his sleep and the adjustments we made. So I think I can share a bit about it, because he's been very vocal about really what it has mattered in the last 10 years of his career. He's the one that asked for help with his sleep. He was 28 years old. Came to the Warriors. This is back in 2014. So now, yes, a decade ago. And he was already an all-star at this point. So obviously found already tremendous success playing in the NBA for 10 years since college. But he knew he wasn't sleeping well. He would stay up till 4 a.m. playing video games, and he would sleep for a couple of hours. He would go to practice, come home, take this very long 2 to 3 hour power nap. And it wasn't that he wasn't performing well, he was, but he said, you know, I want to have as long of a career as possible. I'm 28, the average age of retirement in the NBA. So I'm sure he had foresight that his end would be approaching at some time in the foreseeable future. So what could he do to extend that career? And he asked for help. We got connected, and I started to help him recraft how he approached his sleep. So that meant not just the hour before bedtime, but it was also thinking more strategically of even his daytime habits so that they would set himself up for better sleep at night. For example, that meant cutting down his very long 2 to 3 hour power naps. We cut them down to 20 to 30 minutes. We timed them closer to game time so he would actually get that benefit as he was going to be in game. We looked at his nutrition. We evaluated his sleep environment. So it was now dark and quiet, cool. We dropped it down to 67 degrees. 60 to 67 is what has been shown to be better for sleep. We really tried to be strategic of the process that he would do every day to prepare to sleep, which meant, number one, processing his thoughts and his racing mind outside of bed with breathing and with stretching before he even actually then would did reading as that relaxing wind down. We made sure that that was set up for every day, so he actually was more intentional and proactive with his sleep than just jumping into bed and reacting to whenever, you know, the end of the day came. He specifically would put away technology. So this is now 10 years ago, there was something called airplane mode where you wouldn't get calls or messages during the nighttime. And so he made sure that was on and or just didn't even have technology in his room to be tempted by it. I could go on, but as
What was the breathing method? Because there's so many breathing methods, you know, box breathing, or what was there some particular breathing method he used to calm down?
I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I actually don't recall if he used a specific breathing technique. I will say that I do recommend certain breathing techniques that activate your parasympathetic system. Yeah. And then will help dampen down your sympathetic system, because a lot of athletes who play late night games get really sympathetically driven, right? That fight and flight response is just overactive because you've been playing and now it's hard to amp down post game. So I do really encourage breathing exercises so your parasympathetic system gets triggered before you actually then do something that's more relaxing.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm asking just because there's so many different ones, but I think at the end they all have the same effect. It's just kind of to calm your system down a little bit and prepare you, just bring that energy level down, which I have a hard time doing with it.
Yes,
but yes. Also moving into post game, what did he particularly do, or players in general do after games? Because I remember that I was around players that had to take either melatonin to fall asleep, which I don't know the long-term versus short-term effects, but also Stilnox was also something that the sleeping pills just to fall asleep faster, it helped them fall asleep just to get that full night of sleep, but it's not necessarily healthy. So after a game, what's the calm down routine after a game?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think, as I mentioned, making sure that he had that foundation of processing his thoughts and the racing mind that so many athletes are thinking through what happened in the game, thinking through what they need to do the following day to prepare. Many of them do that when they're in bed, and then it becomes this vicious cycle of being awake for hours and not thinking that they can fall asleep. So being more strategic of giving him time before he gets into bed. So specifically, you want to do this either outside of bed or in another room. He was doing the stretching, breathing exercises. As I mentioned, we made sure that whether he was at home or traveling, he was trying to optimize the sleep environment so that it would actually be conducive to sleeping, and bringing some sleep tools that can be helpful when it's less than ideal. I do recommend like building a travel sleep kit that has things like an eye mask, earplugs, a travel white noise machine, curtain clips, so you actually can keep the curtains closed. I know you're smiling because you've seen this happen, because the curtains won't stay closed and it's not dark in the room. Having a journal so you have a way to throw down information or thoughts that are swarming in your head, leaving it on your bedstand so that you're not grabbing your phone in the middle of the night. If they're looking for one, I have all of these like linked on my LinkedIn just as a starting point, because I think it's so helpful to have these tools at hand when you're on the road and something comes up that you have less control around that environment. So those were things that we made sure he did, as well as then giving himself the window to try to get he would always get 7.5 hours. Sometimes when he was injured, he would increase that duration. And then also making sure that he was trying to time his sleep appropriately as well. So obviously much earlier than the 4 a.m. bedtime that I think sometimes he often did in seasons prior. And the really cool thing is that as we started to make these adjustments, a third party quantified those results over the season and showed that as he went from under 7 to 7, 7.5, 8 hours, his points per minute went up 29%. His free throws went up 9%, which is exactly the same 9% I showed in the Stanford men's basketball study. His three-point percentage went up twofold. Turnovers went down 37%. Fouls went down 45%. And he's been very vocal about how this really impacted, you know, not just that season, but subsequent seasons. And in a neat way, that following year, the Warriors went to the championships for the first time. He came home with the finals MVP, and since then has had 3 more championships and ultimately 10 more years of a career. So yes, he just retired, but it's really neat to see now in hindsight what that career looked like with now a little bit healthier foundation of sleep.
Yeah, that's so cool. Like, you think about it, athletes are hard to convince sometimes. Like, they have to really be either desperate, you know, or they have to feel like a little bit of, oh, there's something there more. And usually it's with older players. The younger players are so stuck in the beginning that they already know and they want to do it a certain way. What was the first aha moment? Because we just talked about the low-hanging fruit that, you know, like you said, from the travel kid that you bring with you, you just do the little things at first, and then you kind of feel a little bit of improvement here, a little bit more energy, a little bit more endurance, better mood. What was the first aha moment for him, or maybe in general for athletes where they feel like, wow, I feel different?
I don't want to speak for him, but if I recall, I do think it was even a short wind down routine. So I think I challenged him initially 5 or 10 minutes of a relaxing routine that will help prepare you every day. So reading, I think, is what we had started with. And I think just that simple change and realizing then it was easier to fall asleep and then during the night get, probably from a duration standpoint, would that extend it as well? And then really it was that the connection of making, you know, sorry, connecting those dots from those changes and how he felt in the daytime and ultimately on the court was, I think that was at least the initial aha that there is something to this. It doesn't take a lot and I don't have to change my whole day. But if I'm willing to give 5-10 minutes before sleep to be better set up for better rest and recovery at nighttime, it actually might be a smart trade-off so that I'm actually going to be better the following day. And so I will say that's actually one of, you know, one of the ways I really challenge everyone to think about sleep slightly differently is that sleep's not the end of today. It's the beginning of tomorrow.
And that's something that with competitors, with high level athletes, you have to challenge them. And that's the thing that gets to them. You challenge them on a particular thing, small wind down routine. They do it. They stick with it. They see a result, and then they feel like there's something more to it, and then they keep going. And that's one thing that we were going back and forth before this podcast about certain things that I can relate to, maybe also in Europe. And I see a lot of rookies that come over from the States, first year rookie, sometimes even second year, where they completely live on an American schedule at night. They are at night, they're talking to their friends, they're talking to their families, they're trying to be in touch with what's happening back home because they're still very close to college teammates or whatever. And they come to the shoot around or the practice the next morning completely out of whack, completely, you know, and everything is just, the whole week is just a drag. And then you go to game time, it's the same thing. So the rookie seasons, for players who come on for the first time and they don't have an idea of the difference and the importance of sleep, it can make or break you. And then you go back to your familiar environment and you leave things behind without having reaped the full benefits of your sleep schedule.
Yeah. Have you seen that evolve over the last 5 to 10 years with players or even coaches, as we've talked about before?
I've just talked to a coach recently and he wasn't aware of the importance of sleep. So I think it's very individual based. I think some coaches are more in tune, maybe with the biohacking community, more in tune with some things that are happening outside of basketball. I specifically try to be a T specialist and try to get information that's outside of my area of expertise and try to apply it to my area of expertise. And that's you know, there's coaches and managers or scouts like that as well who are also listening to podcasts that are don't have anything to do with basketball. And that's where you pick up information like that. At some point, I also know other people from this business that were also in the biohacking community that were trying to, you know, Oura Ring, for example, or other like Whoop Strap and supplements that were taken just to get a little bit of benefit in the day where you feel like keto diet, you know, it's a fad diet and it's debatable, but for a small amount of time that you do a change to your body, you see the benefits and you're automatically like, oh, I'm kind of hooked. I want more. I want more of this. I want more of this information. Is there any supplementation players or coaches can take for a better night's sleep? I remember magnesium has different parts like 3-in-8 and something else that you can take to enhance your sleep as well, right?
Yeah. So supplements and sleep aids aren't always come up as a topic that athletes and coaches want to know about. I will say that the American Academy of Sleep Medicine doesn't recommend any supplements that we feel specifically help with sleep. And so while I do have athletes that use magnesium, you know, it is not one that has very strong evidence that is specifically is helping with sleep. I think some individuals use it for relaxation, et cetera, but the evidence isn't that strong. You've asked about melatonin. It is one of the most commonly used supplements. But if you actually look at the meta-analyses, the benefit of using melatonin when you're in one location, so when you're at home and trying to use it to fall asleep, the benefit is only really about 7 or 8 minutes faster to fall asleep, which is not that great. Some of the other strategies I've suggested in terms of that wind down routine of trying to have like writing a to-do list, journaling, et cetera, some of those have been shown to be actually more effective long-term than any of the sleep aids and supplements. Where melatonin can be helpful is specifically when you're traveling and experiencing jet lag when you travel eastward. And so that's where the evidence is stronger that melatonin can be helpful to shift your body clock, specifically eastward. And so taking that for before sleeping. Yeah. And
but how many days before to travel?
Oh, not so. Usually most people will take it when they get to a new location and are trying to advance that clock when they travel eastward. And so that can pull that clock towards it if you take it about 30 to 60 minutes before bedtime. That is a scenario that has stronger evidence. You just want to be mindful. If you've never tried melatonin before, I wouldn't suggest doing it for the first time right before an important event. I mean, there can be some side effects of grogginess with melatonin, and obviously with elite athletes, where you're sourcing it from and making sure that, you know, it's NSF Sports certified, at least that's what we do here in the States, then those are just things to be mindful if you are going to use those. Tart cherry juice comes up as one because there is anti-inflammatory effects with it, and there's some evidence around the benefits to sleep because of the melatonin, but they are very specific cherries. So but in general...
I didn't understand.
Oh, tart cherry juice?
Tart cherry juice, huh? Interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's at least one that's become more popular here in the U.S. for athletes. But I will say again, most of the evidence is around the anti-inflammatory effects.
I need that. My back is hurting.
There isn't like a magic bullet of, you know, one sleep aid or supplement that we definitely know is going to help you sleep. And I think that's the challenge, right, is the lifestyle behavior things that we know are going to be honestly the most helpful to set you up for good sleep. Does take time and diligence, but that is going to be the healthiest and safest way to really make sure you're getting the best sleep possible.
All right. So we're slowly coming down towards the end of this podcast. And just as you have the Nappuccino, I usually have the ATOs that at the end I pop out quick questions. I prepare some Nespressos for you. So it's going to be a quick Q&A at the end of this podcast. So best Twitter follow or Instagram follow that has to do with sleep besides yourself?
Oh, okay. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine is our national organization. They are, I think their handle is AASM.org. They at least will put out the latest recommendations if there's interesting studies there. So it's a good one to follow just to stay in the know for the latest on sleep.
Most overvalued fact about sleep?
Overvalued fact. I think a lot of folks have this misperception that alcohol is great for sleep, that it's going to be helpful for them to just knock out after a nightcap or a few drinks, obviously, with friends. And while it can help you fall asleep, it really fragments your sleep at night, and the quality of your rest is not the same. So it can prevent you from going into rapid eye movement sleep, and you can just feel more fatigued as a result. So not your best friend.
Sleeping with partner in different beds is healthy. Fact or fiction?
It can be. So I know this is an interesting one, because a lot of bed partners believe that if they're not in the same bed, that, you know, it is reflective of, say, the relationship. And that's definitely not true. There's an interesting study by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine most recently that did show about a third of Americans occasionally or consistently sleep in another room to accommodate their bed partner. And that's huge. And that may be because they have different schedules, and maybe because one is more disruptive with snoring, which, as a side note, should be evaluated with a primary care doc or a sleep doc. So snoring is not normal. And then when you break it down by even the generations, it's 43% of millennials are sleeping in another bed or bedroom, one-third of Generation X, and 28% of Gen Z, 22% of baby boomers. So when you break that up, it's still a large proportion of individuals that are really in different sleeping situations, so that they both can get the best sleep possible.
Most popular question about sleep.
Most popular question about sleep. Can I pay back sleep debt? Which I think we dove into here, but
yes.
It is one that I think is a misconception that you cannot pay back sleep debt. And that is not true from what I've shown in my research and what others, that at least short-term sleep loss can and should be paid back with sleep extension.
Snooze button, good or bad?
Ooh, not good. The snooze button, you really want to minimize. And then it's really because you are fragmenting the last, say, half hour. If you're going to snooze for a half hour, maybe you're snoozing for an hour. You're really just fragmenting your sleep versus having the consolidated sleep all the way until when you really do need to get up. And remember, you get most of your dreaming REM sleep in those early morning hours. That's critical for learning and memory consolidation, to be able to retrieve that information later. Think of it kind of like the save button. And so if you're breaking that up, you're really not giving yourself the best chance of getting the full benefits out of that REM sleep. So no snoozing. Or if you have to, because I get it, people love it, do it once, 5 minutes later, then get yourself up.
Yeah, just get in the vertical position, sit on the bed, and then slowly it's going to come out. Because the longer you lay down, the longer you want to lay down.
Exactly. Open up the curtains, get sunlight. I also say, as a strategy, plan ahead for something that you look forward to doing, whether it's your favorite breakfast or enjoying a hobby that you can do for a few minutes, something that will then motivate you to get out of bed.
How rare is the gene mutation that allows people to function at 3 to 4 hours of sleep?
So this is called short sleepers, and there are some individuals in the population that we do believe don't require that 7 hours minimum I talked about before, and they're called genetic short sleepers, but they are rare, and the prevalence, we think, is probably less than 1% of the population, even though I will say many more individuals think that they can function on that amount of sleep. It's probably not true when we actually look at testing them. So these families are very rare. They have some specific genetic mutations that allow them to get less sleep than the average individual and still perform objectively on tests at a sufficient level. And so some of them are actually being studied in San Francisco here in the Bay Area, and it's evolving as they start to understand more genes that are associated to this, but it's rare.
Yeah, it's like those wannabe tough guys that are just like, I can function. Last one, and this is from Tim Ferriss, because I that's the one of the inspirations that I have why I do this. Favorite failure. Something that you failed at in the past that you feel like that taught you the biggest lessons, and you look at it with a smiling face.
Oh, this is a good one. I have made a lot of mistakes and learned through my career, but if I had to identify one specific favorite failure, there was a point in my career that I wanted a specific job, and I had prepared for it for years, and it was what I thought I wanted to spend the next several years doing. And ultimately, I wasn't offered the job. So at that time, it was pretty crushing, and I was very disappointed. But when that door closed, it forced me to really rethink what it was that I wanted to invest my time doing. And I had to force myself to reflect on what it was that I would really find rewarding for the next couple of years. And in the end, you know, I realized today that I'm not where I am if that door didn't close. And so that silver lining is that I am grateful for it, because it led me down this path where then I had more bandwidth to figure out different projects and avenues to utilize my research and expertise into what I do today as a consultant, as a researcher, and as a physician. So, yeah, I think that's my favorite career failure, and it has led me to where I am today.
Dr. Sharma, everyone, thank you for being here. You're doing more than just raising awareness. You're really, I think, saving players' careers, extending players' careers, raising awareness to coaches, and helping franchises to be at their best. So keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for coming on. And please let everybody know how they can find you, because there's a lot more, I think, to unravel there.
Perfect. Yeah, thanks for having me here. It's been wonderful. And if you're interested in learning more, you can either follow me on Instagram, X, LinkedIn. My handle is Dr. Sherry Ma. That is DrCHERIMAH. Or you can go to my website. It's www.drsherryma.com. So www.drcherimah.com. You can also sign up for my newsletter and keep you in the latest on sleep and any tips and strategies to help you sleep your best as well.
And dive into the mom method.
Exactly. Come join.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Thanks, everyone, for being here.
Thank you.